Have you ever wondered if a business could thrive as a democracy, meaning more people give inputs? And I'm talking about your employees. Well, what if we changed it up and said employees not only have input, but they have ownership of the business? Well, it's clearly worked out for the Cheese Board Collective. They aren't your typical pizzeria or cheese shop or bakery. They were founded in the 60s, and they have been going strong in the city of Berkeley, California for what feels like forever. They are an institution, and part of it is because they have amazing food, but another part of it is they took a revolutionary step and became a worker-owned cooperative. And in this episode, I speak with Vanessa and Radcliffe, and even though they have a love for the business, even though they have a love for worker-owned cooperatives, you can tell that they don't think the same. They're not necessarily on the same wavelength every single time. Yes, they have a lot of shared values and beliefs, but you can imagine with 50 employees plus all having an input, that can make coming to a consensus harder. But they truly believe in the worker-owned model, and they are advocates for it. And in this episode, we'll be diving into the Cheese Board story, what works, what can be improved. And this is an amazing episode. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And remember to always ask, what's good, dough? Hey, hey, Pizza Pal, I need a quick favor. Before we continue on with this episode, I need you to do one thing. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, please make sure to do so. And if you think you're subscribed to the podcast, please double check. Apple is doing some weird stuff with how it all works. And unfortunately, my podcasts are not being sent to your Apple device unless you re-opt in. And I want you to get all the latest and greatest episodes. I want it to be available to you, not just when you want to tune in every Sunday, but like, what if you're not tuning in every Sunday and you just happen to go on a hike or you're making dough and you're like, what should I listen to right now? Well, I want this to be available and ready for you. So by turning on the automatic updates and subscribing to the show, you'll have What's Good Dough ready for you. All right. So thank you so much for doing that. And also, if you're on Spotify or anything like that, go ahead and just double check too, because apps feed off one another and they tend to follow in the same direction. The final thing I will say is we have an email list. Make sure to sign up for that. The link is in the show notes. That way you get notified when there is a new episode. All right. I appreciate you for listening. I appreciate you for being here. Thank you. Just to set the stage a bit, right? It is a Sunday afternoon. We're in Berkeley, California, in this, would you call it a historic house?
It is. There are actually historical features to this building that we have to check in with the city about before we do any renovations or construction. Mm.
And so with it being a historic house, Vanessa had told me that you all own the building.
We have recently purchased the building.
And it's like a huge building.
Yes.
Yeah, it's massive.
It's massive. Tell me about the building itself. Or what do you know about it?
Early 1900s, mm-hmm. Right?
I don't know. I know very little about the building. I'm so curious to know more, honestly.
Yeah, I don't know a lot of the details, but we have 4 retail spaces that we now own. So there's the pizzeria, the bakery, and in between the two is a small hairdressing studio, which will stay. And then on the corner for many years was a produce market, which closed just before the pandemic, I think. And we took over the lease at that time from our landlords, or from them, but we were renting from the landlords. And so we have 4 retail spaces plus tenants that live above the bakery and corner store space. And then the building on the other side of the parking lot has apartments as well.
What was the year that you all purchased it?
Last year, right? 2023?
So both of you were there?
We were both here, yeah.
Okay.
Very recent. I almost thought it was this year, but no, it was the end of, maybe like toward the end of last year.
Yeah, I think it was officially the end of last year. It's a blur, honestly.
Yeah, it all happened very quickly.
Then that just begs the question, why was it purchased?
Well, I mean, people had been talking about purchasing the building for a really long time. As soon as the opportunity arose, we made it clear to the landlords that if ever, for whatever reason, they decided to sell, that we were interested. But I remember, I mean, there was some weird, like, confusion. We had someone standing outside, like, taking pictures and looking around, and someone was like, who is that? And so someone approached him and was like, oh, well, yeah, the owners of this building are trying to sell. And we're like, what? They didn't tell us. And they just assumed that after the pandemic, we weren't in the financial position to make an offer. So they just decided, oh, we'll just like put it straight to market. But then we reached out and cleared up the misunderstanding, like, oh, no, of course, our ideal is to sell it to you. And we worked out the finances. And then the whole process, I think, start to finish was like a month, if like
it was
maybe
fast.
Yeah, so
it was really fast,
and we were all really excited. I mean, it was something that we as a collective have been really excited about for a long time, the prospect of owning our building.
People had been talking, it's the collective when you refer to that, right?
Exactly.
It's not just a Vanessa and Radcliffe idea.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long have you all been in this building before that actually happened?
The late 60s.
1960.
Yeah. 1960. I can't remember when they moved from Vine Street to here, but 69, maybe?
Yeah, 69, something like that.
The cheese board started in 1967 as just a regular business and then became a collective in 1971. It started off as a very tiny little cheese shop around the corner at the same time when Pete's was coming into play. And so then we moved into this space as we started growing and then became a collective and have been expanding from the bakery space into the pizzeria space, which expanded again. And then now we're taking over the corner store spaces as well. So
this is basically it then, because that the old location wasn't even part of the collective before.
Right.
Right.
And so this is where history has been happening. Right. That's so fascinating. It took almost 60 years for this. It's a 6-year process from when you first moved in to buying this, this place.
Yeah. We were very passionate about the opportunity to buy this place because if anybody else bought it, there's a good chance, you know, our rent could get jacked up to the point where we wouldn't be able to survive here. And so it was really important for us as stewards of this business to help ensure the longevity of it by purchasing the building.
Was with it being Berkeley, and I don't know too much about like rent control when it comes to anything. It's not my zone of expertise, but I have heard of like folks in Alameda County. Is that the county that you all are in? There is rent control for people who live in like residential. Was your rent protected, or at least did the landlords respect the fact that you all are like OGs of the spot?
They've been amazing. They've been really incredible landlords. At the first couple of years of the pandemic, I think we were rent free for a couple of years.
It's amazing.
Yeah. They were part of the reason we were able to survive the first couple of years of the pandemic.
Mm. Little did they know pizza is sort of a bulletproof business, right?
Right.
Or was it hard in the pandemic?
It was tough. People had doubts. And I was a candidate when the pandemic started. So I was still in the process of being brought on as a member. And I, coming in, didn't know all that much about Cheese Board. I wasn't too familiar with the legacy and the fact that it was so renowned as like an institution of Berkeley and sort of propagated out and became like this whole California pizza movement. But I just saw the lines around the corner every single day. And I was like, this place is bulletproof. I mean, of course, we'll be fine. And then as time passed, I mean, I recognized the challenges and I became more familiar with the finances. But really, time just continued to confirm for me that we have such a passionate and loyal client base. And we're so intertwined with the community. I mean, people won't let us fail. I think if worst came to worst, you know, people would go out of their way, I think they would come together and keep Cheeseboard alive just because of what it means to the community. And, you know, it creates such an amazing atmosphere, the live music and the line around the corner and the parklet extension and all of that activity just feels so integral to this area of Berkeley, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I'm constantly humbled by how people have integrated us into their family traditions and their lives, like their day-to-day lives. It's amazing. People will stand in line for 45 minutes to get a slice of pizza, or people make it a point every Thanksgiving to get the special Thanksgiving pie that we make every year. People come back from college, you know, because they grew up here and went to Cheeseboard their whole childhoods, and they'll go away to college, and the first thing they'll do when they come back is come to Cheeseboard. Before they even hit home, they'll come from the airport to the Cheeseboard before they'll go home. It's amazing. Yeah. Very humbling.
You're the hometown slice.
Yeah. Right?
So what was it like in the pandemic then when that happened? 45 minute waits were reduced to zero.
I mean, when did we start again? I think we reopened in August or something. Or
June. It was June.
Okay.
So we were closed about 2.5 months. And like everybody else, we were doing all this, you know, planning about plexiglass cages and, you know, sanitation, hand sanitizer stations and all that. And we had to figure out a new way to sell pizza.
Yeah.
We weren't super busy at first, but it picked up pretty quickly, and we're still not at pre-pandemic levels of sales, or volume, but we're moving in that direction slowly but surely. Part of it is also we've lost a lot of our membership. A lot of people left during the pandemic. So we're trying to build back up the numbers of workers that are here so we can expand our hours and offer more hours to our customers.
Would you say that part of the reason why the sales aren't the way they were is because of the reduced hours compared to...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the factor.
Yeah, it's a huge factor, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's part of what I wanted to talk about is the fact that we're here on a Sunday. You all are closed. And most pizzerias, I would think, would argue that Sunday is the place to be out of your pizzeria. Why are we here today and you all aren't working?
We've never been open, I think, on Sundays. It's been a day where we've had, sometimes we'll do events, we'll do fundraisers, we'll have other events, but it's a day for maintenance to happen. It's a day for us to rest. We need a break. We work really, really hard. So I think just traditionally we haven't been open on Sundays. Yeah, that seemed to have worked for us so far.
It's just like a component of the collective mindedness of this place. We just give ourselves a day to rest, and being worker owned, we have the capacity. We're empowered to make those sorts of decisions. So, you know, you could look at it as like a questionable business decision, but it is so important to just keep us well rested, keep the morale of the group up. And I think ultimately it translates into us making better pizza and just being happier in general. So it's totally that sort of thing.
Yeah. I think also occasionally we'll open for a Sunday for a special event. Like we did it for Christmas Eve last year. We did it for Super Bowl Sunday. And it's super exciting for the community when we're open on a Sunday. It's getting exciting for us too. So that's always fun.
Super interesting. Yeah. Super Bowl Sunday, one of the busiest days for pizzas. And so to open up on that, you like feel the energy and you feel the excitement. Do you then take a different day off in the week? Because I understand you all are open on, you are closed on Monday as well. So you do have that break. You do have that gap after a busy Sunday like that. But how do you make up that extra day that you lost?
I mean, well, so when we open on Sundays, usually it's on a volunteer basis. Like we're paid, but, you know, we just ask the group who's willing to come in on Sunday and make this happen. And people will usually jump at it just because they're excited to engage with the community. But as far as like who gets days off when, it varies person to person. A lot of people, even though we're closed on Monday, come in, you know, do a lot of prep. Same on Tuesday, the pizzeria is not open for hot service yet, but people are still in there doing a lot of prep work, making par bakes for the bakery next door. But we work really hard to keep work-life balance sustainable for everyone. And so we have this process of like creating a schedule that's kind of convoluted. But what usually happens is people decide on the number of shifts they want. Some people only work 3 days a week, you know, and that works because other people are willing to step up and say, I'll take on those extra hours. So whatever people feel is sustainable for themselves, that's all we ask of them, you know.
With it being a collective and a lot of people are involved in decisions, right? Is it then harder to say, hey, there's an event on Sunday and they want, and we want to be involved in that somehow? Is it harder to make that decision? And what does that conversation look like?
I feel like with that decision in particular, maybe it's easier.
Yeah, that seems like one of the easier things we discuss.
Okay, there are so many cases in which a decision that would be instant for like a corporate, you know, structure take us a really long time. I mean, even something like, literally months, like something like, you know, deciding to serve green sauce in smaller containers. It's just like deadlock for months on end. It'll just get pushed meeting to meeting to meeting. Because there are so many people and so many differing opinions that even like the most trivial stuff, people get really impassioned about it. And it just like, it's exhausting. It's worth it, but it's exhausting. So, I mean, there are a lot of different cases where like we'll be stuck on something that just seems so ridiculous for like
trivial almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's true. Something that might seem super obvious to me might not be obvious to somebody else, or they'll have a completely different opinion about it. And we have to find a way to work it out. There's a lot of compromise. There's a lot of persuasive talk. There's a lot of griping. We call them grumbles sometimes.
Let's talk about the green sauce a little bit more, because it seems like a concrete example, right? How does that even like get brought up? Like, and maybe describe it. Was it like going from a 2 ounce to a 1 ouncer? Like, what was the problem? How did the problem get notified to the collective? And then what ensued after that? Walk us through, because like people listening on the other end don't even, some people don't even have a pizzeria, but the people who are listening, they own the business and they're like, okay, if I wanted a 2 ounce cup to a 1 ounce cup, I would just order the materials the next day. So explain it to us.
Well, I think it came up because customers, we only had an 8 ounce container. It was the only container we offered. And before the pandemic, we had a pump. So people could come buy a pizza and we had those little like 1 or 2 ounce cups.
Sample cups. Yeah.
And they would just fill them up and go. But this problem started happening where people would bring like mason jars or, you know, and they would just pump. And it's like, we can't, come on, you guys. So eventually post pandemic, and partly because, you know, it was like a sanitation thing. It was, you know, we didn't know how COVID was spread. So we didn't want to have this communal pump. So then we were like, okay, we'll only sell it in the containers. But after a while, people were like, 8 ounces is a lot. Like green sauce is fantastic and delicious, but like, this is kind of insane. So eventually it became common knowledge that people were wanting a smaller container. It came up in the meeting. And anyone can bring an agenda item to the meeting. That's part of the beauty of this collective structure. If you have an idea, you can make it happen. You just need to be convincing enough that everyone will vote yes on it. I don't remember who brought it up, but for whatever reason, green sauce in particular, anytime there's an item around green sauce, it ends up being contentious. So I think it took us maybe not as long as some of the other conversations, but at least 2 or 3 meetings before we decided, okay, we'll actually do this.
Yeah, some of the arguments against doing a smaller sized container were that it's more labor, right? You have to fill up a lot more containers. It's more waste potentially with the packaging.
Plastic.
Actually, Berkeley is required that we use compostable packaging now, which is terrible packaging. Like there are no good compostable.
Yeah, it's just falling apart, it's disintegrating. Just,
we're not there yet.
We're working on it. It's better than it was, I guess, though, a few years ago. So there's the labor, then it's what do we charge? How much do we charge people? and it's not what we used to do. There's a lot of attachment to how things used to be. Although I think in this case, people were pretty happy to get rid of the pump because customers abused it so much. Yeah. It just became unmanageable.
Kind really of annoying. Frustrating. So, yeah. Yeah. I think we need to double click first on this green sauce, right? Because it, did you all popularize that? Is that your thing?
It is. Do you know the green sauce?
Oh, I know the green sauce. Yeah. I haven't had it here, but I know
that you haven't had green sauce. Yeah, exactly.
To be fair, I know the influence you've had on others, like Diamond Slice, mm-hmm. right? They do a green sauce too, but I think it's an homage to your green sauce. Yeah,
it is.
And there are other places that do it as well as an homage to you all. Yes. So I've only heard of this legendary green sauce, but I think, you know, for people listening, like, and myself, please educate me. Tell us more about it.
The history of it is not really clear because different people take credit for inventing it.
Sure.
But there is one person who did actually write up the recipe. So it is a blend of whole serrano chilies that are destemmed, garlic, citrus juice, Dijon mustard, cilantro, oil, a little bit of sugar and salt, and some rice wine vinegar. And it's blended together into this amazingly delicious
thing
that you dip your mm-hmm. pizza into. And there's some put aside for you to try a little bit later. So you'll get the real thing.
What size container am I going to get? Do you guys have the
8-ounce container? Yeah, it's gotta be. You get the big container. We're not giving you baby containers.
So you all ultimately make this sauce more available to customers who couldn't just fathom getting an 8-ounce cup, even though it's pretty warranted. Like, it's delicious stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can always make use of an 8-ounce container, but I get coming in, getting one slice and being like, well, I don't need the same amount of sauce as pizza.
For sure. Because I think that's what happened to me at Diamond Slice. I think they made... This was in the pandemic, and I want to say, I don't think it was 8 ounces, but I think it was more than I needed. And I was like, well, I either get it or I don't. And so I was like, well, what am I going to do with the sauce? And it is what it is, but it makes so much sense because I think too, aside from like people taking advantage, I think the pandemic showed pizza makers like stuff costs money. Mm-hmm. And it can make or break a restaurant that has, you know, to pay attention to the numbers and all of them should be. Pandemic taught a lot of pizza makers that you can't just be giving stuff away like that for free.
Yeah. And it's been a hard adjustment for people to understand that we can't give it away for free anymore. And that's another reason why we took the pump away, was because we just couldn't afford to do that. We make on an average Thursday, we make 15 gallons of it, and it requires 6 gallons of oil. So imagine like an olive oil blend, like how much that would cost. Like it costs us a lot of money.
For sure.
And with the cost of goods rising, it wasn't tenable to just give it away anymore. But I think most of our customers have been understanding. Some are quite disappointed, but I think that's rarer that we see people coming in upset about that. But, you know.
Our customers are very chill. That's one thing I'll say. I don't know if it's like a Bay Area thing or a Berkeley thing. We have such understanding, forgiving customers. Anytime we have to raise prices or like make a change that's like a little bit inconvenient, people are like, oh my God, I get it. You know, and it makes you feel really good. Cause I've been in the service industry my whole life and I've never experienced this thing of like customers like preempting me being like, don't worry. You know, it's always like, oh God, here it comes. Like, so
yeah, people, when we first started opening again, they would just come up and just thank us profusely for being open and thank us personally for working. Just thank you for being here. And it was like incredible. And it still happens all the time. Yeah.
I think part of it is, you know, being in Berkeley, there's a culture around here. I think part of it too, is you all command this respect as an organization for, I used the word earlier, being OGs, right? I mean, there's something to be said about a organization that can stay alive for that long. So you have to be doing something right.
Completely.
Yeah.
Your track record speaks for itself.
Yeah.
And you build fans off of that who will support you and will shout for you and will be loyal for you and defend you. And if people don't get with the program, they can just go find a different pizzeria. There's plenty around here.
Yeah.
Right?
True.
All inspired by Cheese Board in one way or another.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll stop.
I see the slivers out there, the sliver pizzeria out there. They're doing that. I see some faces made whenever I mention other pizzerias. So what's the beef? Is there?
There are a couple of pizzerias that have a cheese board style pizza and that's fine.
Yeah. We don't need to say any more than that.
Yeah. I will say that there are a couple of pizzerias that have cheese board style pizza that I adore. The Arizmendi's, obviously. And there's Nick's Pizza on Shattuck and Alcatraz that Nick is an Arizmendi alum. Have you been there?
I passed by it.
It's so good.
Okay.
I love them. I just love them. And yeah. Nick sold the business to his workers last year and became a collective.
That's so cool.
It's so awesome. So I occasionally will leave work, and because I drive that direction, I'll go and grab a slice at Nick's because I love them so much. So and they have really, really good bagels, just FYI.
So what is it against other pizzerias that are not the Nick's or the Arizmendi's? Is it like, I'm not even going to say anything. I just want to hear from y'all. Like, what's the beef?
I don't know. I don't know what I'm allowed to say.
Well, you can say what you're thinking, and if you want me to delete it, I can.
One pizzeria was started by sort of a cheese board defector in a way. Ex cheese board member who left and started a pizzeria. Same principle, same, you know, one pizza a day, green sauce.
Yeah.
The only difference is it wasn't a collective.
Yeah.
So it's like, let me go take this profitable idea and then see if I can personally profit off of it. And that just doesn't sit right. You know, just it's
that does not feel good.
The culture of cheese board, pizza, green sauce and all is also the collective. It's the cooperative nature of it. And so I think that's part of why some of the other places that it feels less like an homage and more like a, you know, it's like a replication that's just not as
good. Fake.
A fake. I hate to say it, but yeah, kind of.
It's a fake, and yeah, and with, and they don't deny when people say that they are like cheese board affiliated. They don't correct people on that. And so that feels bad because it's not a cheese board condoned business. Like we didn't launch them or like
right
the way we did like the Arizmendi's. That I'm super proud to say and happy to say, like, yeah, Arizmendi's amazing. And
did you help build the Arizmendi's program or did they help build yours? I know there's a very close connection. I don't know exactly.
Cheese Board helped Arizmendi. There was an impetus to spread the collective model around. And so we gave them some seed money and recipes and sent over some of our workers to help open Arizmendi Lakeshore and get them established as a collective. And now they're 5 Arizmendi's.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's great. And those Arizmendi's are like sprouting other collectives like Nick's. So
if you're going to borrow the idea or take the whole idea, right, as it is, as a package, do you condone that? Or I guess the question is, do you want more cheese boards out there? Period.
I kind of think yes. And my personal opinion is you start the business you want to start. And if it looks a lot like what Cheese Board is doing, that's great. Then more people have access to the Cheese Board style thing. Of course, I'm a huge advocate of collective ownership. So I'm saying if you're going to do that, consider collectivizing, consider making it cooperatively owned.
No, I mean, I straight up say like, take the whole package as it is, like
right.
The collectivism and everything.
Yeah,
right?
That's the ideal for sure.
Yeah, I don't think we need like baby cheese boards, but I would really encourage anybody who's thinking about starting a business that is conducive to the collective model to do it. It's a ton of work. It's really hard. But I think I like that I feel like we don't have a choice but to participate in capitalism. We just don't have that choice, but we can do it in a way that's kinder to each other and supportive of each other. And is just better than traditional capitalism. We take care of each other, and that's the most important thing, because without the people who work here, there's no business. That doesn't exist. It won't exist if the people aren't here to take care of it. And so we need to take care of ourselves. So a lot of the decisions we make are about how to care for ourselves, and to care for the business as well, so that we can care for the business.
What are the non-obvious benefits to having this collective, aside from taking care of its people, aside from spreading this idea into other businesses to make this, instill fairness in places that wouldn't be fair? And by say fair, I mean like giving workers a voice and ownership. And what are those benefits?
Well, one to me is ideas aren't just getting lost. You have a group of people who are on the floor interacting with the community. Of course, they're going to come up with great ideas. And I think in traditional hierarchical structures, their voices aren't heard, or they just don't even feel motivated to bring it up. It's like, for what? I'm not benefiting from this, even if I think it might benefit the business. We're all incentivized to make Cheeseboard the best experience for everyone as possible. And being invested, you come up with ideas and you bring it to fruition on your own. And we had a committee recently that I was a part of that was like, okay, well, we want a more inviting seating area outside. We have this parklet that's historical, and we're like, okay, let's extend it to the corner. And I helped design it, and seeing it now there in reality and people enjoying the space and making use of it in the way that, we sort of envisioned, it's just so beautiful. And that's not possible without the collective model. And if I didn't have the power to say, let's do this thing, and a group of us didn't have a power to, convince the group and get the money for it and get the contractors, and there it is.
Yeah, it was a really cool process because we all knew we needed expanded seating. And the question was like, and it's one of those things where we kind of were like, yeah, we really need to do something about this. And then we finally got it together and started talking about it. Radcliffe specifically came up with a couple of designs, and we could say like, well, what if we, did this or changed that? And there were like six or seven of us on that committee at one point. We made adjustments here and there, and now we have this beautiful space outside with more than twice as much seating as we had before. So it's great.
That ownership really makes you feel like you created that, right? Mm-hmm. Versus like an employee who is not part of a worker-owned thing. They may put their idea in a suggestion box that like gets just thrown away in the trash, even though it's a solid idea. Mm-hmm. And so from idea to endpoint, it goes through a series of, I have this idea, I bring it up at this meeting as a collective, and then it gets voted upon to see if it gets discussed more. Am I on track?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Please feel free to.
Yeah, there's usually some discussion if we're ready to vote on it. So we'll usually do like a straw poll and see like, okay, how are people feeling about redesigning the parklet, and how do people feel about this particular design? And if it seems like we're still really split, then maybe we will hold off on a vote and discuss some more until we can get to a point where we can have a clear vote with a clear answer.
Okay. So when you get to that clear vote, is it a simple majority? Does it have to be like a 60-40 to be certain? What is that process like?
There are a couple of different thresholds depending on what we're voting on. For most votes, it's... I can never word this right.
It's a little bit complicated, but basically of all the people voting, no more than 25% of people can abstain. And, if you meet that threshold, then okay, then the vote moves forward. Of the 75% of people who are voting either yes or no, 75% of that group needs to be a yes for the vote to pass.
You said 75% of the 75%?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So 75% of the yes or no votes needs to be a yes.
And abstaining is basically saying, like, I have no comment at this time, so I don't even want to, like, participate.
For a lot of people, an abstention means I'm happy to do with what the group wants, but in effect, it is often a no vote. It works out to be a no vote. So people have to use it kind of carefully.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So within the 75%, a 75%, it's like a supermajority there, has to say, I'm down. And then from that point, you all say, let's build a committee to take this on?
Yeah, a lot of the time. If the person who brought the proposal has an idea for what implementation looks like, we usually defer to them. If that looks like building a small group of people or a committee to take it on, then we'll do that. But a lot of the decisions don't always require that, or in the implementation, super simple.
Or there's a committee that already exists that it makes sense to delegate that.
Yeah. Into. If like Radcliffe is like saying, it'd be nice to have a parklet, and Vanessa happens to just be sitting there hearing the conversation out loud, like, I kind of like that idea. Automatically, it's almost like that's the start of a committee.
Yeah, I think that's actually how it worked out. I think it was like, okay, who is anybody interested in joining Radcliffe and figuring out the parklet? And I think a bunch of people just jumped on it. Mm. That's not always the case where everybody wants to jump on the committee, but in this case it was.
And like you described it as like a straw picking thing, right? And I like when it comes to the ideation of something, like
about a straw poll. An actual vote, but just to gauge.
Okay. Yeah. Straw poll. Yeah. And what does that look like? Cause I imagine a lot of ideas don't even make it past that. Right. That moment where it's just like, we're pitching. And I don't know, I'm a union organizer by trade. And so when I'm in negotiations with just the team, it's like the loudest voice wins in a way, or the person who can make the strongest point and everyone gets to go, uh-huh. But sometimes it's straight like brute force.
Right.
Where something gives it the opportunity to be brought up to the table to be discussed with management. How does that like look for y'all?
We try to mitigate that, but there is some of that effect also. I mean, there's a lot of vocal people and, you know, they can be convincing and it is not always necessarily the right decision. I mean, it's hard to make that judgment, but our meeting process has all of these checks. Like we have a facilitator that tries to get as much participation as possible from people. We have a lot of room for discussion. That straw poll is just a process of, you know, if we've only heard from three people and they're really vocal and they're very clear about what they want, let's see what the rest of the group, the silent majority, actually thinks. And then that can give us a better idea of what we as a collective are actually wanting. Because a lot of the time you'll hear those vocal people and then you'll see the results of the straw poll and go, okay, it's not just this. Or like, we're not just of this opinion. We're a little bit more split. And I think that's like essential to keeping us on the right track, because otherwise it would end up being like anyone who's willing to do that brute force thing of being like, I want this. They would just, you know, dictate every decision.
It's annoying, by the way. I don't like, it's happening. I'm like, really, this is how you guys get things done.
It's great that we have this process, and it's also exhausting because a decision that could be a very simple yes or no in that moment is up for discussion for 3 months. So, or longer. There are plenty of examples of that, but.
So why do you keep doing it?
Because I don't want to do capitalism the way I would have to do capitalism if I didn't work here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what brought you here?
Primarily, yes. I also have a long history in food service, and it's the work I love. So that was a great match for me. And I happened to be looking for work at a time when we were hiring and kind of got lucky. So
it was a values-based decision. It was like, this is what I know. Oh, and by the way, I vibe with this organization's way of thinking. mm-hmm. which made it a perfect fit for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a perfect fit. It is a, okay. It is a fit. There are things absolutely that are hard, and that if I were to do things from scratch, might be different, or I don't. But you know, it's hard.
Yeah.
I don't.
Perfect is a strong word, but like it. If, yeah. Yeah.
When I have mostly waited tables and bartended for most of my restaurant career. There's been some back of the house stuff. There's been some expo, but mostly it's been table waiting and bartending. And it's great because you go to work, you work super hard, you go home, tune out. You don't have to think about work until you show up again to set up. Right. And I loved that. It's not like that here. Like I think about this place all the time and I think about my coworkers and their well-being. I think about how to maintain my own well-being as somebody who tends to work too much because I just get overly focused on what I'm doing. And I think about how important this place is to the community and how important it is for us to maintain this place. And I truly think of myself as a steward of the business, and I want to see it last for as long as it can. And so, you know, in that regard, does that make it a perfect fit? No, it's I'm tired, you know, but I also love it. This is the kind of work that I love and that I get to do it to the benefit of hopefully myself and for the people that I work with on a day-to-day basis, all like 50-ish of us right now.
50-ish.
Yeah. I just counted. I think we're 46 members, 7 candidates and 4 interns at the moment. Pre-pandemic, we were like 73 members. So we have lost a bunch. Gained some, lost more, gained some. So we're growing again, but
you know, I'm becoming more and more okay with like the duality of life. You can't take the sun without the rain, the good with the bad, the stress and the love for the job. It all is like packaged together and you just have to be okay with that. Yeah. Right. Call it stress, call it 10-hour days, call it whatever. Right. But it has to just fit with your idea of what balance is, or at least just allow you to keep showing up for whatever it is you're showing up for.
Absolutely. I've think more than ever in the last couple of years, I've really learned that conflicting things can exist in the same space, right? Like I adore the people I work with and I also want to scream at whoever put the labels in backwards. On
Was this an intern?
Who did this? I always have to remind myself, okay, somebody I really like and care about did this. Don't get too upset. But those things exist in the same space.
And then Radcliffe, you came on working in the service industry. You were a candidate. I'm curious to know, you didn't really have this idea of becoming a member, is that what you said earlier?
I didn't know much about cheese board specifically.
Okay.
But when I applied because it's a collective.
Oh, okay. Excuse me.
I spent some time working on at this like retreat center, the whole long story, but the way that it was run was almost there. It was so close to being like fulfilling in the same way that a collective is, but we still had that top-down structure. We still had to defer to the judgment of someone who just wasn't working on the floor, didn't know what was going on. So we had this like really tight-knit community and we had this sense of like fulfillment and investment in our work, but we always felt undercut. And I was like, I need to find something where I actually am empowered to make decisions. And learning about different models, different business models, I was like, oh, it's gotta be a collective. It's gotta be worker owned. And so when I moved out to the Bay, I'm from New York. I moved out to the Bay and I knew that the Bay was sort of notorious for having this like collective,
for sure,
being the collective hub of the country, maybe of the world.
Berkeley specifically.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like history here when it comes to Berkeley itself. There's a UC Labor Center, right, where they promote that as courses at a university level. So it's just this whole culture is so ingrained in it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you were like, I want this. Talk to me about how both of you all went from like, do you start off as a candidate or do you start off as an intern? Yeah, please.
Everyone starts off as a candidate. The interns, there's separate intern sort of programs. There's a teen intern program where we bring on a couple of high school students to work part-time. And then I think I mentioned to you, it's kind of a rare thing that happens, but one of the Arizmendis is closed temporarily. So we've taken on two of their workers as interns. So it's not something that usually happens, but the idea with, when we say we're hiring, the idea is that we are hiring people to work as candidates for 6 months with the intention of bringing them into membership at the end of that 6 months. So everyone who is a member was at one point a candidate.
Mm-hmm. And the difference between intern and candidate is maybe they're not here forever, like the Arizmendi people. But what's the other difference between an intern candidate?
The interns aren't on track to, so the interns are not on track to be members and they don't generally attend meetings.
At all.
Not at all. I guess there might be an exception, but the current ones don't attend meetings. They don't have voting power. They don't have keys. They don't have keys, but they get the other benefits, like being able to buy things at cost, or they have healthcare, right?
Yeah. Interns have healthcare.
Yeah. So that's another really cool thing is all the candidates we all make the same amount per hour. We're all hourly, paid hourly.
Intern, candidate, member, all the same pay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No matter your longevity.
Yep. So if you're here day one, you're making the same as somebody who's worked here for 40 years right off the bat. You get healthcare off the bat.
Is that fully paid? Does everyone contribute?
There are two healthcare plans that we have right now. One of them is you don't pay at all, and another one, the other one, I'm not sure what you pay, but
you can, I think you can choose how much you pay monthly or like
there are tiers
in the paid one. There's tiers.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
The fact that you all have healthcare is freaking great.
Yeah.
I started working here when I was 48 years old and that was the first time in my entire life that I had healthcare, that I had PTO. Candidates and interns have PTO also. It took me, 27 years in the restaurant business to get to a job where I had healthcare and PTO.
Mm-hmm.
Bonkers.
And then from candidate to member, it's a 6-month process. You said something about voting. Do you get to vote as a candidate?
You can participate in straw polls and give opinions about non-confidential matters. And they are required to attend meetings when we're not dealing with confidential issues.
What's an idea? What's an example of a confidential issue?
Personnel evaluations,
okay.
That kind of thing.
So personnel evaluations are public between the members?
Yes.
Mm. Interesting. Is that hard?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right? Because they're your peers.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's almost hard to not be biased when those discussions are happening.
Yeah. I mean, it's impossible to not be biased, but we do our best to check that bias. We have trainings.
Oh.
Yeah. And so there are a lot of other benefits, a lot of workshops and trainings and stuff like that to just teach everyone to be a part owner and, you know, take on all that entails.
Yeah, I'm someone who's actually on the committee that administers the evaluations, and we've rebranded ourselves because everybody hates evaluations. Nobody wants to be evaluated, but what we've done is turned it into what we call a teamwork facilitation committee because the idea with an evaluation is to get everybody to work better as a team.
Right.
Right. So we want to be able to show up to work, feel good about who we're working with, about the work we're doing, know that we can get the job done in a timely manner, not break ourselves in the process. And so the teamwork facilitation survey, not evaluation, that we put out gives every member a chance to say what they think a particular member's strengths are or where they see room for improvement. So, you know, Radcliffe could be filling out my survey and say, like, you know, it really is detrimental to the shift when Vanessa shows up 5 minutes late every day. It would really be helpful, Vanessa, if you could come to work on time.
Wow. I can see how that's very powerful.
It is. We're working on it. It's hard. We're learning to talk to each other in this way and support each other in this way. Hard. And, you know, people have good days and bad days and good communication days and bad communication days. So it's something that we're really striving for. And I mean, I've been here almost 6 years and it's the best I've seen it. By a long shot,
for sure.
By a lot.
I mean, that's the goal, right?
Yeah.
To be better than yesterday.
Yep.
Otherwise, it's not sustainable.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it comes to, I mean, that, are the trainings that you create to help each other, are they done in-house? Are you creating that training program to be able to evaluate someone better? Or are you sourcing them from other organizations or businesses? What does that look like?
It's both.
Both.
Mostly it's outside facilitators. I think it works a little bit better to have somebody from the outside. But those ideas are often generated, are always generated by us. Like what do we need? We need to talk about how to talk to each other more effectively or more compassionately or more kindly or more supportively, whatever. And then we'll have a, you know, maybe a communication training or actually we're having another communication training coming up soon.
How often are these trainings? Are they just ad hoc as necessary?
Some of them are regular.
Yeah.
Like some of them are annual, but they're not always required for all members. A lot of the annual trainings are for candidates.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, so every candidate goes through a series of workshops that include things like a financial, like what it means to own this business financially, what it means legally. Mm. There's an anti-oppression workshop. There's a communication workshop. Mm. There's a workshop with more concrete things like going over our handbook or learning how to use the POS. Mm. What else is there? There's a leadership workshop, which is really important.
And how often are you meeting as a collective to go over agenda items, make decisions, things like that? Are those happening regularly, monthly?
Monthly or more, yeah. We have a monthly meeting that is sometimes split into departments. So the bakery side will meet and discuss like bakery logistics, the pizza side will meet. And then we'll meet as a whole group, all 50 of us, and talk about stuff that pertains to everyone. And we also, in addition to that, have quarterly meetings. And in addition to that, we have committee meetings. So, you know, all the different committees will talk about whatever their committee talks about.
Hmm. Okay. So there's a lot of opportunity for people to come together and make decisions. There's a lot of people. So is it ever hard getting, do people just understand that I need to carve out dates and times for these meetings?
Yes. Yeah. They're scheduled ahead of time. Like it's the monthly meeting is every third Monday with a couple of exceptions for holidays and things, but for the most part.
As a member, because you're an owner, right? Is this considered like paid time when you're going to these meetings?
Yes.
Yeah. Cause like some, like if you think about some people don't take a salary from their work, right? Because they're an owner. And so I'm wondering if some of that translates over as like, oh, I'll take a meeting, but I'm not on the clock.
We used to not pay for meetings. That's only been in the last few years that we started paying for meetings because people felt like it was part of ownership. Like you should just show up and make decisions about your business. I think part of what's been helpful for paying for meetings is that more people show up. The attendance is much better. And I think we also moved to Zoom during the pandemic. And I think that's been helpful too.
Cool.
For people to be able to participate more easily.
And yeah, one thing I'll just add is, and I think this is probably true for any business that decides to collectivize. Part of the reason we decided to start paying for meetings is that a lot of that administrative work, a lot of the work that happens behind the scenes ends up falling on just a minority of people. And so if you don't consider that productive time, if you're not paying for that time, you have a few people who are just taking on all this extra labor.
For sure.
For free.
For sure.
And then some people are just coming in to do their production shifts, do their floor shifts, and they're getting paid more. And it just didn't feel right because it's like, this is work too. And this is so essential to the business. And so I think now that we're paying for all of that labor, it feels a little bit more equitable.
I can totally see that point. Yeah. It could also work in a weird way where it's like only the people who show up control the business. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
I don't want to have happen.
Yeah. That's why we have to just, we're so clear from the get-go. We tell all the candidates, you need to be engaged.
Yes.
Everyone needs to be engaged. Everyone needs to be taking part in all elements of the business, or else, yeah, you get a few people who are just making all the choices.
You get a defector too out of that too.
Get a defector. And they go and start a pizzeria. It's off brand.
What does that look like? What happens if Idriff comes in and becomes a candidate and becomes a member and then you don't like me? Not that you don't like me, but clearly there's like some process, right? Or is there? Mm. Do I just voluntarily step out, or are there ways to be voted out? Because people, they may seem good on paper.
Right.
Well, that's part of what the candidacy period's for.
But 6 months isn't a long time.
It's not a long time. So the candidacy period works for us to get to know a person and for them to get to know us. There have been candidates who've started and just been like, I don't want to do all this extra work. Like, this is too much. I want to punch a clock. And that's fine. Like, that's great. I totally get that. And in 6 months, you can get a sense of somebody, and, you know, maybe being voted in as a member triggers something and people's personality, like something else comes out. That's happened too. But like in any place, like there are processes, there's a personnel committee that helps to deal with, like accountability issues. And, that's not personnel. It's, recognition, I think, right? Or I guess recognition and personnel. There are committees that deal with like those kinds of issues as they come up. And it happens sometimes that people will be voted out.
Ah, so they get voted out, but they also get voted in.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So at 6 months, if they don't get voted in, is there like an extended probation time?
No, it's really, so the 6 months, in that 6 months, we really try to address any issue that comes up as it comes up. And there's a vote that actually happens every month to continue the candidacy.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you're not even like guaranteed a job for 6 months. You have Okay.
So, and part of, but as owners of the business, one of our jobs is to train and to mentor everybody who comes through as a candidate.
Absolutely.
It's a really, really important part of the job to be a manager and to be a trainer. And so part of that is giving feedback, teaching people how to do things that they might not know how to do, whether it's spinning dough or it's giving or receiving feedback. Like there's a lot of training that happens. And so we have weekly check-ins with the candidates and say like, here are things that we'd like to see you work on. Here are things that you're doing great. Keep this part up. Let's see if we can get you to do this other thing. You know, usually we see steady improvement throughout the candidacy, but it does happen occasionally that it's not a good fit for whatever reason.
Mm.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's on you as members to train and grow your membership because there's a benefit long term, right?
Absolutely.
The idea here is that the more members, the stronger the business.
Not exactly.
Yeah.
You're not incentivized to grab members. You're incentivized to get good members.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what it is. We want to bring people on who are invested and consistent and reliable and mesh well with our culture. And that's really hard because this is, for a lot of people, a very novel structure.
It's not for everyone.
Not for everyone.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a novel structure. I think that's a great term, because I think a lot of people are sort of fascinated by the idea, don't really understand how it works until they get here. And then they're like, whoa, I have 50 managers right now and everybody's telling me to do something a little bit differently.
Wow.
Yeah. And so part of candidacy, and one of the things we focus a lot of attention on during candidacy is acknowledging that they've got 50 managers and that they might be getting conflicting information sometimes. And everybody has a different communication style and a different way of working. And that is really hard to manage. Especially when you're in this trial period, right? You don't really know what's going to happen. And, but we also are really clear about the fact that our job is to nurture them to membership, so that they can feel comfortable and confident as a member once they are voted in.
One of the things pizza makers spend the most money on is cheese. Every time I have a catering event, cheese is my biggest ingredient cost. But what if I told you there's a cheese company out there that lets you earn cash back for every pound of cheese purchased? I'm talking about Baggio Cheese. And their Gold Club Rewards members receive their rewards card every month that can be used wherever Visa is accepted. So the more cheese you buy, the more you can earn. Literally, you get paid to use Baggio Cheese. Now that is cool. Learn more at Baggio Cheese using the link in the show notes. Let's talk about pan pizzas for a quick second. What are you using to press out your dough? I found out that whatever fat you use greatly affects the flavor of your pizza. And that is why the only brand I trust with my pizza is Cordo Olive Oil. Taste is everything, and other brands and other fats pale in comparison. Do you want to taste the difference? Go to cordo-olive.com using the link in the show notes. You can purchase a bottle there, or if you're an operator, you can get a free tasting. Just message me and I'll connect you with them. I'll leave my contact in the show notes. Thank you, Cordo Olive Oil, for sponsoring the podcast.
As owners, I imagine you get your base salary, whatever that may be. You get to make your decisions. But as owners, you also get profit sharing. That's huge, right? Because most organizations, most employee, like if you're an employee, it's rare at a different business. But if you're employee owned, you become a member and you own the business.
Right.
And in theory, in an ideal world, ownership leads to an incentive for the business to do well.
Yeah.
Correct?
Absolutely.
With it being part of the culture of anti-capitalism, is that profit at the end of the year or quarterly or however it's distributed, like a weird topic to discuss?
I don't think so. It's not weird because we have, you know, like issues on principle with like getting profits. It can be weird if we're struggling financially and some people maybe think, let's not distribute profits this year. Let's put it back into the business. And we do have a structure for that. I think there's a fixed percentage that goes back into the business that isn't distributed. But since the pandemic, I mean, financially, you know, every restaurant has been struggling. And despite the fact that we are, you know, successful enough to maintain business, we're not seeing the same, you know, huge profits that Cheese Board had seen in the past. And so you're not guaranteed to get profits every year. You're not guaranteed to see that patronage come to you. And sometimes the expectation was that we all will take on that loss, actually.
Oh, right.
A vote happened during the pandemic that decided that the business would take the loss instead of the individuals. And I think that was huge for navigating that very tenuous period where people were unsure of, you know,
must have been hard.
Everything. But yeah, I mean, ultimately the profit sharing, that's a huge incentive, huge benefit of being a part owner.
Am I reading it correctly that since the pandemic, has there been a profit share?
There has been one, yeah.
And when you say that the business took the loss in the pandemic, are you all as an organization required to hold a certain amount of reserves then Or how does a business take a loss if it's employee owned?
Well, so employee ownership is sort of the way we refer to it nominally. Legally, we're not owners, so we don't have to put business owner on our taxes, for example. And we get a lot of the benefits of ownership, but I'm honestly not so familiar with like the technical legal structure of it, but what I do know is that the way we distribute profits is like very complicated, and it's not easy to sort of reconcile with the IRS, and it's just confusing. So I guess I don't know much more than that, honestly.
Yeah, I am very bad at articulating this stuff, so I'm not gonna try because I will mess it up.
Okay. I wish, is there not a simple analogy that we could use as a even quick and even inaccurate framework, but just like to put it in a person's mind, like what goes on when a business does well or does not do well? Do they just like, yeah, what framework could we like reference, if anything, as simple it may be?
Well, if we have a deficit, I mean, there are a few ways that we can approach that. I mean, we can give ourselves a pay cut, which is something that we've done and we've had to do recently. And that's a very hard decision, as you can imagine. But, you know, we go through that same voting process. And if we figure out, listen, this is what the business needs, we'll take that. And we were lucky enough going into the pandemic to just have a lot of cash in reserve. And so some of the loss we could just pay for out of that reserve. And then we just have a bunch of other measures of cost cutting and trying to get those margins back to where you want them to be quarter by quarter by quarter. And we're on an upward trajectory, which is really encouraging. And I think a lot of people are optimistic. We're doing great business right now. But yeah, I mean, the pay cut thing, that was tough. And I think that probably has had the biggest impact on that deficit that we felt like we were in for a long time.
The deficit, and also would you say that that's affected how many members you've brought in overall?
Yeah, I'm not sure that was why people left. I think, well, you're on the hiring committee. Maybe you could speak more to like why people come in. But I feel like they're in general like interested in the collective model, and we have a pretty decent hourly for the industry. So I think people are attracted by that. And then whether or not the ownership part is a good fit is a different question.
Right. Right. So what do you think it is? What's stopping this same member number compared to the pandemic?
I actually don't think there is anything stopping that. I think we actually have just made the decision to be a lot more gradual in our growth, because we're trying to focus on creating a culture that's like really accepting and just feels better in general. And I think you bring on too many people too quickly and it can sort of throw that out of balance. And so we've made a decision as a group, and it's not, you know, it's not unanimous, but for the most part, we've decided that we're not just trying to jump back up to 70 members. And we probably could. I mean, we get a lot of applicants every time we put out a job posting. But we really, like we were saying before, we're really intent on bringing people on who are going to be a really, really strong fit.
Yeah, absolutely. We at, you know, in labor, there's some chapters, right, where it's hard to get membership. And some people will just sign on because they were sold, right? They're like, pay your union dues. That's the right thing to do. They pay their union dues. And then it's like the worst possible thing because we get disgruntled members that end up trying to tear their union apart. Whereas if they were properly vetted and selected and, you know, given the opportunity to just pass because that would have been the best thing for their union, they were forced in a way, and it created more harm than good. And I think at the end of the day, what you all are conveying here is culture is at the very top. Quality is at the very top. And that is the only way we continue as an organization to be strong and to be prepared for whatever's to come in the future, is that we have a strong, strong culture here.
Yeah. And I'll say that this example of people wanting the business to grow gradually, and you know, you said it wasn't unanimous. It's one of those things that is very much not unanimous. Like, there are some people who would hire 20 more people all at once if they could. And I am a person who wants us to stay smaller. If it were possible for us to stay smaller, I would love that, because I think we could focus even more on quality and just taking care of the people that are here. Like, I don't really want us to get bigger. But I don't think that's going to happen. Like, I think there is a movement to grow the business or grow the membership more. But you know, we'll see.
Time will tell.
Time will tell. And it's all about compromise here. So you don't always get what you want.
Can you tell the story about the dropping of the salary? I'm like so curious, because that's hard.
I don't know. I don't know that there's all that much of a story. I mean, after the pandemic, having such a drastic reduction of membership, had to bring our hours way down also. So I think in the pizzeria, we were open for hot pizza service like 9 hours a week. Which is very little. And so, you know, despite the fact that while we were open, we were doing really well, it just wasn't enough to, you know, make the money that we needed to pay everyone and pay all the overhead costs. And so we saw that we were operating at a loss. We got a few consecutive, you know, financial reports that were looking pretty rough. And we realized we have to do something, actually. This is an existential threat to the business. So, you know, as hard as it was, it didn't feel optional. And I think we all started to realize that. And we sort of negotiated our way to a smaller raise. I mean, a lot of people wanted to go even more drastic, or smaller pay cut, rather. And a lot of people wanted to go a lot more drastic, but, you know, we're all people. We all have our own financial needs, and
we need money to live in the Bay Area.
We need money to live in the Bay Area. I mean, the Bay Area is insane. So, sorry.
Do you both live in Berkeley?
I live in Oakland.
Oakland.
I live a 10-minute walk from Cheese Board. Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It is beautiful.
No, I don't think people understand how beautiful it is.
It's insane. Right?
I'm curious to know, what is the salary here? Can you talk about it?
Can talk about it. Yeah. Our wage is $28 an hour, which was down from 30. And in addition to that 28, we are accruing PTO. And I think after a year, like if you were working like an average of 35 hours or something, that adds up to like 5 weeks of paid time off.
Whoa.
Which is also unheard of, especially for the service industry.
So, I think just for any and almost any.
Yeah, industry. Yeah, exactly.
If I look at my union contracts, the people who start their first 5 years, they're only at 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We're incredibly.
That's why we had to reschedule our conversation last time, because you had such great PTO. You were gone for like a month. Yeah.
Well, first I had COVID, and then I was in Thailand.
That's unheard of. Mm-hmm. To be able to say, I'm going to travel outside of the country, mm-hmm. and I work in food.
Yeah.
That's freaking cool.
It's amazing. Especially, living in the Bay Area, cost of living, sky high. It's like...
Yeah. Only like some waiters and bartenders get to do that.
You know? Yeah. If you're like in a fast paced high end bar.
Yeah.
Right.
That's dope.
It's amazing. I mean, that is why a cooperative model is so powerful.
It is, because instead of one person at the very top getting all of those profits, it's just given to this community that actually runs the business. I see your.
God, every time I hear I think about people who work at Amazon or McDonald's or whatever, and just, you know, they do these breakdowns of like how much Jeff Bezos actually makes per hour. Like, sure. It's like $8,000 an hour, whatever ridiculous. And I get so frustrated and so mad, like a lot of people do. And it just doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. And no. I, more than anything, want the existence of the cheese board to serve as a way for people to understand that it doesn't have to be that way, that all the money we're making is for us and for the business. And there's nobody at the top. The question I always get is, who's at the center? Like who, there's gotta be like a center, and there isn't. There's nobody that's not doing the work that we are doing, who's making extra money. That's why I call myself a worker owner. Most of us call ourselves worker owners because it really drives home the point that we own the business, but we are in the trenches every day.
Right.
And that's really, really important to me.
Yeah. It's so interesting because it's like you all operate no different than any other business, right? Aside from the fact that it's very like there's the collectivism at the core. Mm-hmm. Like if a business is struggling, the owner doesn't take as much profit. Or they cut staff. They don't cut themselves, right? But they do, they adjust and you all adjust as needed, but in your own like parameters, right? Everyone takes like a $2 pay cut versus whatever a single owner would be considering versus layoffs,
right?
I would argue that's so much better because if a business is tanking, you see a 20% employee reduction and then people are screwed.
Yeah.
Whereas taking a $2 hit means $4,000 less a year if you're working full time. At least you still have a job. At least you still have PTO. At least you still have healthcare. At least you still have an opportunity to make things better at your workplace for next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
What does taking profits look like?
Well, so the way profits are distributed, we set aside some money for the business. And then when we decide how much of the profits is going to go toward patronage, and that's that profit sharing,
patronage, you've said that word before. Mm-hmm. What is that? Is that the collective or is that,
it's just another term for profit sharing. When I say I'm getting patronage, I'm getting some piece of the profits.
Gotcha. Sorry. Thank you.
And so the amount you get, well, first we take the total number of hours worked, I think it's in a year, and we come up with a dollar number. So if the profits come out to, I don't know, $1 million, and there's some number of hours worked total, you divide that number and you get like $3 an hour or something. And then it's distributed based on how many hours you work that year. So the amount you get is proportionate to
how much you contributed.
How much you contributed in your labor hours relative to everyone else. And that is really fair. It feels really fair. And I think
super simple.
Super simple. And yeah, I think it's part of the reason why I'm still here is because I know the prospect of that profit sharing. I know that my labor, I'm actually going to see the benefit of it.
One of you said you're incentivized to make the business better, like literally.
Right.
If I come up with a good idea and it gets executed well and we bring in more business, like great job us, but also great job me in a way for thinking of that idea. Right.
Yeah.
not to, you know, like toot our own horns, but like it has to stem from somewhere. You get incentivized to speak up for your great ideas. Whereas in a different place, you feel like I should just keep my mouth shut, clock in and out, be done because I don't get anything out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And there are things like that happen that are big and small. Like somebody might say, let's reopen on Tuesdays. And that's kind of a big thing, but somebody else behind the scenes might be calling different vendors to get a better price on olive oil. Mm. And that ultimately has an impact on our bottom line. So there's a million things in between that people do to make the place better.
I imagine, I think it goes back to the straw poll. I mean, like, how do you maintain that shared vision? Like it's kind of hard.
It's very hard.
We don't have a motto or
a mission statement.
Yeah. Oh my God, I'll say motto. We don't have a mission statement. It's kind of a funny thing.
It's fluid then.
Well, Some of us wish we had a mission statement. You walk into an Arizmendi and there's one painted on the wall in front of you and you know exactly why everybody's there.
What is theirs?
I think they have different ones, but I don't know. They all have something to do with like a vision of like, you know, cooperative ownership and fairness and equity right. and all that.
It's almost a little corporate, would you say?
No. Well, not corporate, but just, yeah, kind of like standard, like, you know, it's like what you would come to expect.
Yeah. Or it kind of gives, you know, it gives everybody an idea of like why everybody's there. And I mean, sometimes I wish we had something painted on the wall. So if I'm disagreeing with somebody and I feel like they're not living up to the collective vision, I'd be right. like, why are you here? Like, look at the wall. But we don't have that. Or somebody might do that to me. Who knows? But, I think it's difficult because we don't necessarily have a shared vision. I think a lot of us have a lot of vision in common, mm-hmm. but as a group, I'm not sure if we all have a shared vision.
And you want there to be one.
Ideally.
I definitely do also. Yeah. Or I want more to be incorporated into what's shared because like mm-hmm. Vanessa was saying, I think there's a lot of overlap. Like we all share a vision that Cheese Board be successful, right? But I want it to be more than that. Like we all committing to more principles. And I think that's sort of what we're lacking without a mission statement.
Success is such a broad term.
Yeah.
The fact that you all are here as a community and a staple of your community is seen as success, but are people like working towards that intentionally? Or is it just like a byproduct of like having really good pizza? I don't know.
Yeah. It's both.
It's both. Yeah, for sure. It has to be.
Right.
Yeah. But to have it more clearly defined would exactly. be beneficial.
Yeah.
Well, you two are here. I mean, it seems like it's something that you two could make happen. You all are owners. And in fact, has it been brought up?
A mission statement? Oh, yeah. It's been a couple of years since we've... Yeah.
It's worse than the green sauce. Yeah.
Way worse than the green sauce.
Were you here when we were at that retreat when we were talking about the mission? I think this might have been before you started.
I think
started.
It was just before I started.
Yeah. We've had retreats and meetings where we've talked about even like what the structure of a mission statement would be, let alone like what the meat of the mission statement would be. Yeah, I think it'd be a cool thing to be able to refer to something and say like, this is why we're here. Just if it ever feels like anybody's like going off the rails, like, okay, this is why we're here. And I know why I'm here, but I don't know if that's why everybody's here.
There has to be that collective mission, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
As part of like the nature of this organization, it's collective, right? We all come to see Cheese Board success, but like, what does that mean?
Big question.
Yeah. A lot of companies made MVM mission values, VMV vision, mission and values a big thing the last few years. And it really helps people figure out and understand, is this the right fit for me? Mm-hmm. Right? Am I operating in the way that helps serve the thing that I'm building or helping contribute to? I think it can be one of the questions I ask on this podcast as we wrap up is like, what are the mistakes that people should avoid? And I think people would argue not having a clear mission could be a mistake. I'm not saying it's your mistake at all, mm-hmm. but it could be one. I know, Uni, the pizza oven company, when I was interviewing Dorina, the co-founder, she said, it's all about our culture. If we don't cultivate the culture, if we don't protect the culture, Uni's going off the rails. She didn't say that specifically, but like they protect it. Right. And so it's, they're almost like so closely tied together that those things, even though they're just a bunch of words put together or ideas put together, it's so crucial for some businesses, I believe.
Yeah, it's interesting here because the culture of this place has changed a lot over the years, or the face of this place has changed a lot. This place opened with friends running a little cheese shop. And as they brought on more employees, they were more friends. And so it was a close-knit group, a fairly close-knit group of people who had things in common and shared interests. And they had that base, right, for all the employees, that they had this thing in common. But as we've grown and diversified in many ways, age, ethnicity, culture, geographic, you know, where we're from, what all the things that make us really diverse, you know, it doesn't look the way it used to. And so there's a shift in the culture. Like, I think we used to be much more political. I think we are less political now, though there are very, very passionately political people here. And we're not as close as like a group of friends as it was in the 70s. There are lots of us who are really, really good friends. Lots of us who are really good groups of friends, but it's very different from what it looked like 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
But I'm sure that's for the better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, to me, it shows evolution, right? It's growth, and in a good way. But when we talk about protecting the culture of the cheese board, or if we're talking about protecting the culture of the cheese board, it's sometimes I think back to, like, not that I was here, but what it was like 40 years ago, and how much of that culture are we trying to protect or keep or maintain versus like what it is now or what it even was 5 years ago. Because it was different 5 years ago.
Yeah. It has to evolve. And I think mission statements evolve too. There has to be like a timeline maybe for mission statements to be like changed every X amount of years.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that's very interesting. One of the questions that I love to end with is, what do you want to leave the audience? And I'd like to hear from both of you.
Oh, man.
That feels big.
I don't know. Collectivize. It's really the way. I mean, we've talked so much in the past hour or so just about all the benefits, and it's unheard of what we're capable of doing when we own our workplace and we're not alienated from the profits we're creating. And everyone should have access to that. You know, everyone should feel like they're getting paid a living wage, and like, you know, no one here is rich, but we can sustain ourselves. And everyone deserves that. And unfortunately, not everyone is afforded that opportunity. But the more places that adopt this model and the more widespread it becomes, the more equitable we become on a grand scale. And I think, you know, that is really, really, really important. And so, yeah, I just want to really encourage business owners, employees, just take those first couple steps. Just think about what it could look like if you decided to become a cooperative.
Just being even open to the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say something along the lines of that. But what I would say is there's a different way to do capitalism. You can be profitable and good to each other at the same time and eat delicious food.
I mean, the food has
That's
to
the most
be
important
freaking
part,
good. I mean, there's something to be said about why this business is over 60 years old.
We'll be 57 in November.
57, sorry. I'm not doing math correctly.
That's right. I'll go.
But yeah, there has to be something, like, it's not just the pizza. Mm. It can't be. There's no freaking way.
Well, the pizza didn't even start until the early 90s.
Right.
Yeah.
It was a cheese shop at first.
Yeah.
So it can't just be the dang cheese.
Right.
Something else is brewing here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when you look at pizza longevity or business longevity, that speaks volumes. 50 plus years. You think of like the great pizzerias out there, the Vito's and Nick's of Chicago, or like the Luigi's of New York, right? They have decades on them for a reason. There's something here. I think people need to understand what that is, and hopefully people are understanding, or at least just getting a glimpse of it through this podcast. I'm sure there's way more.
Yeah.
Congrats on what you all are building.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, seriously, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So the Emeritus Program.
So the Emeritus Program is a program for people who've retired from the Cheese Board. Either you have had to have, I think, 20 years here or be 65 or over. And when you retire, you become an emeritus member, and you still have keys, and you can still attend meetings that don't have confidential elements to them. And you can work on committees, and you can actually work shifts, and actually you're required to work at least, I think it's 1 hour a year to maintain your emeritus status. And which also means you have to maintain your food handler certificate. So you're still able to participate in the collective and pass knowledge on to new workers. So when emeritus members are here, especially newer members or candidates are often encouraged to work alongside them so that they can learn old tricks and learn some history. And it's a really sweet way for people with vast amounts of knowledge about this place to keep that information going down the line.
It lives on.
It's really sweet. We're always really happy when we see them pop up. I think we have like 11 emeritus members at the moment right now. That was my last count as of last summer. But
they're still coming every year. At least.
They still pop in. Some of them work quasi-regularly. You'll see them, especially in the bakery. Well, I guess we have 10 emeritus members in the bakery and one in the pizzeria. And the one in the pizzeria attends the meetings every month. And
wow.
He and I are actually about to reinstate field trips. So we bring a group of kids in, and we talk about what it means to cooperate and where food comes from. And then we take them in to the spinning room, and we let them press out a dough ball, and then we bake a pizza and eat some slivers in the dining room. And yeah, it's really sweet.
I like that.
Yeah.
It builds community so hard.
Absolutely. Right?
People, like, kids remember that. And this emeritus program, just, you know, real quickly, are they incentivized to stay aside from seeing the organization grow? Is this like a retirement program for them, or is this really just going back to like seeing this continue to live on?
Part of the reason we have it is because it's so hard to just let go when you retire from Cheese Board. I mean, you've spent so much time, you've poured so much energy into it, you've become so close with everyone.
Yeah.
It's sort of, it's for the benefit of everyone, of course, but easing that transition away, you know, when all of your energy is going into being a worker owner, and then you just retire, and then you just don't know what to do with yourself. So right. I think it's just like, part of it is just being able to stay connected and keep Cheese Board in your life in some way.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes to show that you have to find the right candidates to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't, they're in it for the wrong reasons, but they're really not vibing with what you're trying to create here. And the goal is to spread this idea, to make the world a better place, to make your community a better place. And by finding the right candidates who will eventually become a part of the emeritus program, they'll continue to give back even after the direct incentives are gone. The stuff that pays their bills, that gives them healthcare, that gives them the ability to travel, when all that is gone, if you find the right candidate, the right employee, they will continue to help build this.
Yeah. I mean, how cool is it that when people retire, they're like, I don't want to stop working. You know, I feel like people they retire, they're like, good riddance, I'm done.
Good riddance. Yeah, I can definitely see people saying those exact words.
Yeah, they want to come back to the place where they spent their entire work lives. Like, it's really, really cool. And there are ones that come and do some of the workshops for the candidates. One, there's a history of the cheese board workshop. And so we usually have an emeritus member, or we always have an emeritus member come and sit and talk with candidates about what this place was like.
I'm getting 50 years ago. Somewhat emotional right now. Like, that's freaking beautiful, because like you hear of like, oh, I wish I knew how X was developed or why we do this a certain way. And it's like sometimes gone forever in some places. And like you have this beautiful thing where people just want to continue to give. That's so freaking rare.
Yeah.
And it's so special.
I want to really quick say we have this other benefit, which is that we own a piece of land up in Mendocino County. A group of members, was it in the 90s or... I want to say it was in the 90s. Maybe it was a little later than that. But a group of members built a cabin from scratch just on an empty plot of land. And now it's still up there, available for all the members to go spend time. I've been there 3 times. And it's just, it's so beautiful because I know and interact with the people who built it, you know? And so, and candidates can come in and say, what's up with this cabin? And you can be talking to someone who laid the deck, you know, it's just, it's really, really powerful. And it's also like a perfect example of that collective mentality of like, I'm putting all this work in for everyone who's here now and everyone who will be here, and they get to enjoy this beautiful space. And yeah, I really, really appreciate it. So that I think is really special.
Final question. I always like to end with this. No right or wrong answer. What's good dough?
I love a sourdough.
That's good, because you deal with hundreds of pounds of it every week. I don't know. The stuff we make, because it's like I love that we have our hands in it. I did the math once. I can't remember what, I think I came up with the number 9. But the number of hands that touch our dough, someone makes it, someone decants it, or like not decants it, but gets it into the, like cuts it. Basically, there's a person who portions the dough. There are people who roll the dough. And let's say there are at least 2 or 3 people rolling dough. That's 5. Someone spins it, builds it, bakes it, cuts it, boxes it. There's like 10 people who have their hands on your food before you get it, at least.
Mm-hmm. Washed hands.
Washed hands.
To be clear.
Washed and or gloved. Hair pulled back, no nail polish. That's awesome to me. Like, good dough is made by like good people with like good intentions and good vibes.
Hey, pizza pal. Now that the episode is over, I'd really appreciate it if you did us this one favor, and that is double check and make sure you're subscribed to the show, because there have been some weird things with Apple lately, and unfortunately, you may or may not be subscribed to What's Good Dough anymore. So please make sure to double check that. That way you get the latest and greatest episode of What's Good Dough sent to you automatically. I appreciate you for checking that. I love you. Till next time. Peace. Well, there you have it. My conversation with Vanessa and Radcliffe from the Cheese Board Collective. Man, oh man. Vanessa and Radcliffe, thank you so, so much for engaging in this dialogue and really giving me the opportunity to learn more about this. I use the word amazing a lot, but it really is an amazing model. And I really hope that this podcast can just educate more people that there are other options out there. There is a way to do business differently. And I really think you both did such a great job enlightening us. So thank you so, so much for your time. To you, the listener, you gotta do me a favor and let the cheese board know what's good dough. And if you have any questions or are considering opening up a collective and transitioning your business as a collective, as you can tell from this episode, they're all about that. So please don't only let them know what's good dough by DMing them, but like feel free to engage and ask. I would love to see this model be more available everywhere. And truthfully, we didn't even really talk about it, but with everyone saying it's so hard to get employees these days, I personally think that this is a great way to incentivize people to stay long-term, to acquire and attract talent. I mean, you heard it here. People are not willing to leave even after they've been there and served for such a long time. So please really consider this. I want to leave you with this one thing. I appreciate you. I love you. Till next time. Peace. Do you want a chance to win a $250 Uni gift card? Well, this is how you do it. Within the next 3 months, if you purchase something from uni.com using my affiliate link, send me a receipt. Each receipt that you send me, whether it's yours or a friend's or a neighbor's, will give you one entry into a raffle that will be giving away a $250 Uni gift card. That's all you have to do. All right. Happy buying and best of luck. And thank you for supporting me and my show sponsors.